Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Robert Rabin of the Committee for the Rescue and Development of Vieques, who talks about the next round of civil disobedience actions planned for September in the face of upcoming naval maneuvers on the tiny Puerto Rican island. Anne Whithorn, professor of social policy at the University of Massachusetts at Boston, who talks about the downside of federal welfare reform as the controversial legislation marks its fifth year since being signed into law by former President Clinton. And Kim Gandy, president of the National Organization for Women, who describes her group's campaign to dissuade the cable news network from hiring right-wing talk show host Rush Limbaugh as a commentator. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Over the summer, Palestinian youth held in Israel's Tel Mon prison went on a hunger strike. The teenage inmates were protesting the actions of Israeli authorities that cut off family visits in the wake of the deadly June bombing of a Tel Aviv disco. The hunger strikers have told their lawyers of beatings by security guards. According to the World Press Review magazine, there are 80 Palestinian youth imprisoned at Tel Monde, mostly 15- and 16-year-olds arrested for participating in the year-long intifada. Human rights lawyer Hanan Katab of the Public Committee Against Torture in Israel has taken formal statements from the teenage prisoners concerning the abuses inflicted by Israeli soldiers. The youth complained that they were arrested in the middle of the night, were beaten during interrogation, and kept in prison isolation for long periods of time. The group, Defense of Children International, claims an alarming number of Palestinian youth have been killed and injured during the current uprising. Most Palestinian youth were killed by Israeli soldiers firing live ammunition, rubber or plastic-coated bullets. In the past 11 months, over 600 Palestinians and Israelis have been killed. The majority slain have been Arab youth. Further, human rights activists say the daily violence has deprived many young Palestinians of education, health, and medical services. Philadelphia resident Leona Kaliser survived the onset of ovarian cancer and congestive heart failure. Now she is fighting a credit card company over her unpaid medical bills. Kaliser is presently contemplating bankruptcy. During her treatment, Kaliser qualified for disability insurance, but it did not cover copayment and deductibles, and that added up because she needed a lot of tests. She ended up putting these medical bills on her credit card. She kept up with her debt payments until the disability insurance ran out. Kaliza had to live on a pension and could no longer afford to pay her credit card bill. Overwhelming medical bills are forcing more patients to file for personal bankruptcy, reports the Progressive magazine. But the new federal bankruptcy bill passed by Congress will make it harder for people with large health care bills to file for Chapter 7 bankruptcy. The bankruptcy bill, pushed by the financial services industry, now awaiting signature by President George W. Bush, will force consumers to go through costly counseling before they can file for personal bankruptcy. And in the case of a large medical debt, there is often little that working-class consumers can do to pay their huge credit card bills. Temple University law professor Melissa Jacoby stated, "At a time when we are already struggling with health care finance issues, it is a dangerous thing to do. There will be more people who need access to bankruptcy courts, but this bill makes it less accessible." The emerging living wage movement started out small. In 1994, the city of Baltimore passed the first law to boost the wages of people working for city contractors. The Baltimore law only covered 1,500 workers. Through the last 7 years, the living wage movement, driven by the group Acorn and service worker unions, has passed laws in over 60 cities and is moving into affluent suburban areas like Long Island, New York, and Alexandria, Virginia. According to The Nation magazine, living wage organizers have started to expand their reach to go after big development projects and new hotels that benefit from favorable zoning decisions. Yet most living wage laws have only boosted the wages of a small number of low-wage workers. In New Orleans, ACORN and union organizers are seeking to put a floor on wages to $1 above the minimum wage. A local law is designed to cover 50,000 city workers, many who work in the booming tourism industry. The measure will go before New Orleans voters in February. Seeing the success of the living wage movement, business interests are now looking to block new laws. State legislatures in Arizona, Missouri, Colorado, and Utah have banned living wage laws. Living wage organizer Gula Nodge observes, "It appears this may be the strategy of the chambers of commerce to fight back. They see we are winning, and they are having a hard time defeating us at the state level." This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Zelfia Hunter.
Twenty-four-year-old civilian David Sonnes was killed in April 1999 by an errant bomb during U.S. naval maneuvers on the tiny Puerto Rican island of Vieques. This triggered relentless protests by the people of Vieques, who recently voted in a non-binding referendum for an immediate cessation of bombing and the U.S. Navy's departure from the island. In the last series of civil disobedience actions, many protesters were arrested and served jail time, including non-residents like activist Al Sharpton, who has since been released after serving his 90-day sentence. In early August, the mayor of Vieques, Damaso Serrano, was sentenced to 4 months in federal prison in San Juan, Puerto Rico. Now the Navy is gearing up for a new round of maneuvers in September, and so are the protesters. Robert Rabin is with the Committee for the Rescue and Development of Vieques. He spoke with Between the Lines' Denise Manzari about his group's determination and strategy to end the 60-year legacy of U.S. military presence in Vieques.
What's gone on in Vieques is about as close to a coup d'etat, a golpe de estado, as you could get. The U.S. Navy, the U.S. military, is carrying out actions against the will of the people. Are carrying out military exercises here, despite the fact that the most highly elected official of this country, the governor of Puerto Rico, says no more bombing. In July, approximately 70% of the people voted for the option of immediate and permanent cessation of all military activity in an official Puerto Rican government-held referendum here on Vieques. And just 2 weeks ago, the U.S. Navy, with the help of the federal court system and the federal jail system, have now taken the mayor of Vieques and jailed him for 4 months for his participation in civil disobedience action. We are actually right now bracing for the next round of military exercises and preparing here in the community for our next exercises of civil disobedience.
From the 11th to the 14th of August, there was an international delegation which visited Vieques, and it was organized by the Fellowship of Reconciliation and the Caribbean Project for Peace and Justice in coordination with your group. Delegates from everywhere, from the Philippines, Massachusetts, Texas, to collect information about the impact of the U.S. Navy presence and struggle. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
We have found over the past several years, through participation in these international delegations and also by sending our own delegates from our committee to Korea, to the Philippines, to Okinawa, to other parts of Japan, and to conferences organized by groups like the Military Toxics Projects, among others, that the U.S. militarism is not just a problem for Vieques, but what we see in Vieques is a very terrible example or a terrible manifestation of a horrendous problem caused by U.S. militarism throughout the world. In fact, what we have stated recently is that the U.S. military, it appears to us, is waging a war against its own country, against the United States itself, focusing on Latin, African American, indigenous, and principally poor communities, and also extending outward to territories under U.S. domination like Alaska, Hawaii, and Puerto Rico. And this also continues in countries where the United States military has bases, such as Colombia and Panama and Okinawa and the Philippines, among other places. And we are certainly Vieques-focused, but are also very clear that what's happening in Vieques is, again, a manifestation of a serious problem that affects millions of people, that's responsible for the deaths of thousands and thousands of people. Many, many Americans within the United States are dying or have died because of U.S. military contamination, and many people throughout the world have died because of contamination or violence caused by military forces or military activity in different countries.
The vice mayor of Vieques right now is Henry Gonzalez, with the mayor being jailed at this point. He also signed a contract, a quitclaim deed, under pressure from the Navy in Washington. Do you want to talk about that?
It's a deed that allows the Navy to get away with murder, we might say, in environmental terms. It allows the Navy to get out of its obligation for complying with many of the federal regulations related to the cleanup of toxics in federal facilities. So the quitclaim deed is now being studied by many people who are experts in this area, so that we can begin to talk in the community about an action to be taken to help the Vieques municipal government deal with the problems caused by the contract as it is now signed. People of Vieques have been fighting for over half a century not to have their land given over to other federal agencies or big moneyed hotel interests, but to have that land in under the control of the people of this community. We here are in obviously constant action, constant activity. The Peace and Justice Camp is the principal facility for the protest activity. It's the headquarters for the Committee for the Rescue and Development of Vieques, located directly across the street from the entrance to the bombing range at Camp Garcia. And we have lots of different needs that run from canned foods and batteries of all types and gas masks and flares. We're very, very grateful for all the support, and we just like to ask people to continue talking to their political representatives, their congresspeople and senators, and writing and faxing the president, and doing whatever you think can be done to just raise more consciousness about this issue in your communities.
That was Robert Rabin of the Committee for the Rescue and Development of Vieques. For more information, call area code 787-741-0716 or visit their website at www.viequeslibre.org. It's been 5 years since Congress passed controversial welfare reform legislation. The program that former President Clinton promised would end welfare as we know it has removed tens of thousands of welfare recipients from the rolls, but failed to address the problem of poverty. There are wide variations in state welfare requirements, time limits, and available support services, but all states must abide by strict federal regulations limiting welfare benefits to a lifetime limit of 5 years. Many media reports celebrate welfare reform as a major success, but often limit their examination solely to the decrease in numbers of welfare recipients, ignoring the dire conditions of poverty in which many former recipients are now forced to live. The Personal Responsibility and Work Opportunity Reconciliation Act of 1996, as welfare reform is formally known, will be subject to congressional reauthorization next year. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Ann Whithorn, professor of social policy at the University of Massachusetts at Boston and author of For Crying Out Loud, Women's Poverty in the U.S. She talks about the downside of welfare reform, what poor families are doing to survive, and humane welfare policy alternatives.
I would call it an absolute failure of responsibility and dependability. I would also say that poverty has not decreased in any systematic way for low-income families, and what's happened is that people are out there coping as well as they can without any backup system, and that seems to me to be a major failure for the society, and it makes it even harder for families who've got a lot of strikes against them. For me, the biggest crime of all is the federal government saying that there's a 5-year time limit around which after which it doesn't matter what your family circumstances are, we won't give you any income, even if you do need it. The fundamental thing that's been taken away is the lack of any economic backup. And because that economic backup isn't there, even the other things that seem to remain, like Medicaid support for children or food stamps, are not really very... people often don't know about them, but all of those roles have gone down in most states because people don't know about them, they don't hear about them. I just did a tour of about 10 states talking to people in agencies, and they feel that the word is already out in the streets that there's not much welfare left, and if you go, they harass you, so people don't come to even get what they're eligible for very often because they're even more afraid than they used to be. In Massachusetts, our commissioner of what used to be welfare, now it's transitional assistance, told some of the poverty program directors that she was thinking about instigating an investigation of any family that went off welfare without evidence that they had income because they were probably neglecting their children. I mean, that's a kind of a scary situation that puts every family in jeopardy, and then it puts neighborhoods in jeopardy, and then it puts agencies that are trying to help people in jeopardy. Not that the old welfare system was good. It was abusive and racist, and it made women feel very bad about having to be being honest about their lives, and they were treated very badly in the system. But there was some security there, and now that's gone or at the mercy of individual administrations, individual workers, and it can change whenever a state gets in the mood.
Okay. Let's go back a minute to you were talking about how things might be better or could be better. What do you think are the key ingredients in a humane welfare policy?
There's a group, there's a lot of groups that are working on that. I think one of the key things is that the notion of economic need is absolute. I mean, that if one has a certain economic need, then the state has an obligation. There is an entitlement, if you want to put it that way, or an obligation, if you want to put it the other, that the society protect children from too much economic insecurity and protect families with children in them, at least. There's a lot of other pieces once you say that. No time limits if a family is in need, a decent health care system, access to education and training, and access to wage subsidies, which aren't punitive.
Do you have any statistics about whether there's been an increase in poverty as a result of this five-year-old experiment, or whether there's been a decrease? Or
in an economy that's booming, single-parent families who have dropped off the welfare rolls by, I mean, most places the welfare rolls have decreased by 60%, sometimes 70%, their poverty is only down a small percent, not even a full percent. Now, that's a very... striking figure. Supposedly, when the rolls have fallen like they have, the myth is that that means that the poverty has decreased. It hasn't. It's just changed its face to being now people that are sort of struggling around, putting together various kinds of income, both overtly earning money as well as informal income in communities. And they're poor and they have no place to go.
How are they surviving?
Oh, it's a tough thing. I mean, the same way people have always survived at the bottom third or 20% or so of the economy. When they were on welfare, the wages on welfare were always about 60% of the poverty level. So everybody who knew anything about welfare knew that in addition to getting whatever income you got, you also babysat for your friends, you did hair, did a few cleaned houses for cash. I mean, you did a few things to just get yourself to survive. So now people are doing those, and then they've lost the income base. So they're trying to get more income. The people that are employed now is about the same percentage of people that were getting off the rolls and were employed before the welfare reform. Some people are, perhaps, some of the numbers seem to think that some people are hooking up more with men or involving themselves more with men than they were before. That may not be true. It may just be that it's being acknowledged, or it may be that they're back with batterers or in bad situations.
What are people who are unhappy with the current law doing to try to get something better next time?
There's a range of organizing and information gathering and lobbying going on from professional groups. The most exciting stuff is from grassroots groups that are trying to get the stories out of how hard it is to survive on poverty. There's people that are trying to talk about economic rights in this country and linking it to other kinds of economic rights for living wages and for child care and for all of the other concerns that we talk about all the time, and are trying to make sure that there's a voice of low-income women in the mix.
That was Anne Whithorn, professor of social policy at the University of Massachusetts at Boston, and author of For Crying Out Loud, Women's Poverty in the U.S., published by South End Press. For more information, visit the website of the Women's Committee of 100 at www.welfare2002.org. Progressive activists, already angry about their virtual exclusion from news coverage and commentary in U.S. corporate media, were horrified to learn that the AOL Time Warner-owned cable news network was talking with Rush Limbaugh in hopes of hiring the right-wing radio talk show host as a commentator. CNN, losing ground in the cable ratings war to Rupert Murdoch's unabashedly conservative Fox News channel, presumably hopes to boost viewership by giving Limbaugh a new platform from which to spew what many label as sensational and hateful rhetoric. Although many conservatives criticize CNN as a liberal mouthpiece, studies have revealed that the network offers little opportunity for labor, environmental, or human rights activists to speak to the nation. In response to the CNN-Limbaugh negotiations, the National Organization for Women has launched a campaign to persuade the news network's management to look elsewhere on the political spectrum for new program hosts. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with now President Kim Gandy, who explains why her group is working to stop CNN from giving Limbaugh a larger audience.
Well, you know, it started out just as a rumor that the USA Today reporter heard from somebody inside CNN and then confirmed with Rush Limbaugh, although he said that he didn't admit that he was talking to CNN. What he said was that he was listening to what CNN had to offer. So USA Today reported based on that CNN was approaching Rush Limbaugh, and in fact CNN then did acknowledge that they were having a discussion with him about his hosting a television program on their network.
So what do you think is behind CNN's effort in courting Rush Limbaugh to possibly make an appearance on their network?
Oh, I really think that it comes from the Fox News channel's garnering of a certain percentage of the right-wing listening audience and the hits that CNN has been taking lately. They are frequently referred to by the Rush Limbaughs of the world as the Clinton News Network or the liberal news feed, that sort of thing. Not certainly in our experience of CNN, but they seem to have taken some of that to heart, and the fact that their ratings are somewhat down while Fox's ratings are up mean that they are a little concerned. I think that they are considering going in entirely the wrong direction.
With the critique of the right that CNN is, as you said, the liberal or Clinton or even I've heard communist news network, mm-hmm. I wonder if we'd examine the idea that CNN is somehow a biased left-wing TV network. In my experience, and as you just observed, that is pretty far from the facts.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I don't listen to CNN a whole lot anymore because I actually thought that they were fairly biased in the other direction. But I do think that some of that comes from the criticism. That constant drumbeat that a station is liberal, I think, does in fact have some impact on them, and they start pushing the other direction, even if they were already headed the other direction. And so those folks need to hear from us, and they need to hear from the listeners and the viewers that we want balanced news and that we want news from the perspectives of all of the people in this country and not just a very narrow perspective that is primarily reflected on a news channel like Fox.
Kim Gandy, president of NOW, can you talk about the campaign that you and other coalition partners are now waging to persuade CNN to drop the idea of inviting Rush Limbaugh to host a program there?
Yeah, absolutely. Of course, we've had a campaign involving Rush Limbaugh for several years, ever since we convinced the Florida Citrus Commission to drop their $1 million ad campaign featuring Rush Limbaugh. But this particular campaign, if folks go to our website at www.now.org, you can click on the action alert, click on that link, and send an instant email. And we've had thousands and thousands of emails that have gone out directed to the two top people at CNN, Ted Turner and Walter Isaacson, giving a message that that we want fair news on CNN, and that teaming up with Rush Limbaugh is not the way to increase their viewership.
Very often in these kinds of cases protesting media decisions, the right-wing organizations, the Republican Party, cry that this is an attack on free speech, mm-hmm. that somehow people decrying Rush Limbaugh getting a larger microphone is somehow excluding him from the media and revoking his right to free speech. What's your reaction to that charge?
Well, you know, nobody has the right to have a TV show. If they did, I would have my own show. And, you know, every citizen would have their own TV show. Nobody has a right to have a television show. And these are news networks, at least they represent themselves as news networks, who hire people to report the news. And I think that there are few people who would say with a straight face that Rush Limbaugh is an impartial reporter of the news. So for the first thing, it doesn't even fit in with the whole idea of a news network having somebody like Rush Limbaugh, who is so extraordinarily biased and really bigoted, to be on a news, on an alleged news channel that purports to be fair and balanced. I mean, some of the statements that he makes just curl your toes.
Now, is this a clear-cut call for a boycott of CNN at this present moment if they do decide to take Rush Limbaugh on for a program host?
You know, I think situations like that, you don't really need a boycott. I think people can make decisions on their own about who they're going to watch, and people with good sense are not likely to listen to networks that promote the likes of Rush Limbaugh. And people who feel that way ought to let the networks know that that's how they feel.
That was National Organization for Women President Kim Gandy. Contact NOW by calling area code 202-628-8669 or visit their website at www.now.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced by WPKN Radio's Public Affairs and News Departments. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a cassette copy of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756. Or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Zelfia Hunter, Denise Manzeri, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Archibald Currie.